Hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. This is Stephanie Domingo.
I'm Tex Lursel.
And we be drinking and we be swearing.
We do be doing both of those things.
This is the show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government.
Sure is. Today we are drinking dirty martinis.
Yes.
If you can believe it.
We're going back in time.
Yeah.
We both talked about how when we were in college, we thought we was fancy.
Yeah.
So we were drinking dirty martinis in dive bars, essentially. I know.
Yeah.
I was.
Yeah. When I first turned 21, I just didn't know what I liked to drink.
Yeah, me neither.
And so I would drink those because I thought this is what
you're supposed to be drinking because you're in a bar.
Yeah. And I would get them dirty because I just love olives.
Yeah, same.
Basically, for those of you who don't know For those of you who have never had a dirty martini, it's basically the same thing as a regular martini, but with the olive brine, the juice from the olive jar added in. You can make them with vodka or with gin. Today we're drinking gin martinis, and I'll get to the reasons why in just a second. So in sort of like researching a recipe for a dirty martini and the history that I'm going to get into in a second, it turns out that most modern mixologists and sort of like craft bartenders and cocktail purists really hate dirty martinis.
Really?
Just the idea of dirty martinis. Like, they hate making them. They hate serving them to people.
Seems like an easy drink to make.
Yeah. When I was digging in their history, I came across some very strong opinions. One article said, "The dirty martini enjoys a rich history of being utterly despised by bartenders."
Wow.
Another said something about eye rolls and, quote, wasting good vermouth.
Okay.
And another said, "It's hard to imagine a drink that is equally as loathed and as enduring as the dirty martini."
Why?
I know.
Is it the type of people who are drinking it?
I kind of read another
good vermouth.
Yeah. Another article said something about like the classic martini recipe is like so perfect and so.
Oh, okay.
Like that.
So it's like the purist.
Yeah. That adding that olive juice throws off the balance and blah, blah, blah.
It's like a bastardization of a classic drink.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I can see that.
When it comes to that bastardization, that's kind of the history of the drink. There had been a few similar recipes in print like a few years before it was actually invented, or this version of it was invented, but nothing really was put together in the same way that they were when you and I were drinking them in college.
Yeah.
Until Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Really?
Sometime in the 30s or 40s. Yeah. He loved to mix his own cocktails. He loved to like kind of play with cocktails during his like children's hours.
Mm-hmm.
That we mentioned in episode one.
Yeah.
He like had his own bartending set. He loved to like play with cocktails, and he absolutely loved martinis, but it said that he never mixed them the same way twice. He would always play around with the recipe.
Mm.
He was always tinkering with like the ratios of gin to vermouth.
Okay.
He was always adding like fruit juice or other flavors, just something to kind of like...
Yeah, make it different.
Yeah, just experiment with flavors. And it's also said that most of the drinks he served were famously terrible.
Okay.
I think one of the biggest reasons that dirty martinis are so despised.
He's like, how is this with milk?
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. He just like threw some olive juice in one day because there's olives in a martini. So he's like, why not?
Yeah.
There's all this olive brine left in the jar.
Okay.
I'm going to try it.
The rest was history.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool.
I think one of the biggest reasons a lot of people don't like them though is that most bars use the like really cheap, poor quality Spanish olives with the pimento.
Yeah.
And I read a lot about like trying to make a good dirty martini, and everyone was like, use really good olives.
Yeah.
So
easy.
Don't use the poor quality Spanish olives and you'll have a good martini. Today we're drinking martinis with a Sicilian variety of olives called Castelvetrano that are like, I mean, they're more expensive than but they're not crazy.
Mm-hmm.
They're, you know, super reasonable. And I found them at my local grocery store. I didn't think that they would have them, but they did. So you can do it. If you want to drink a dirty martini, you can make it happen. Oh, one last quick note before we dive into the story. When you're skewering your olives for a martini, I read that it's bad luck to have an even number of olives on the skewer. So when you make this, either make it with one olives or three. one olive or three.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Bad luck.
Bad luck.
Ooh. Yeah.
How weird. But I know. Yeah, it's like the reason there's no 13 floors in a lot of buildings.
Totally.
It's so stupid. But yeah. All right. I guess we should cheers.
Oh, yeah. To our dirty martinis.
Yes. With three olives because three we're olives. Not trying to get the hex put on us.
Ta-da!
When I was a kid at school learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
It's...
Well, you made them extra dirty. Which I did I make like. Not extra dirty, but dirtier than.
It's not my favorite. I don't know why. I loved these in college.
I drank mine with vodka.
Oh yeah, FDR always made his with gin, so that's what I did. But I always drink mine with gin too. Back in the day.
Yeah, it's just been such a long time since I've had one, and my tastes have changed significantly since then.
Yeah,
it's still good, but I wouldn't order it.
Totally. Yeah. I'm not gonna not drink it.
Yeah. Oh. Same.
Yeah. I'm going first today. I guess I'll just dive right in. So in the last episode, I was talking about FDR, if you'll remember. And I was talking about some of the other women in his life.
Yes.
And today I'm going to be flipping that coin. And I'll be talking about how FDR's wife, Eleanor, also had other women in her life.
I like it. Equality.
Equality, yes. So Eleanor Roosevelt was a super fascinating woman. And to be honest, I think the part of the reason that I love the Roosevelts so much, in my head it was FDR, but the more I research Eleanor and the more I learn about her, the more I realize that she is the reason that I love the Roosevelts.
I'm not very shocked by that.
Yeah.
I didn't know, but I'm like, okay, I believe it.
She's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was one of the most active and progressive first ladies in American history. And along with all of the good work she was doing on her own, most of the literature on the Roosevelts agrees that she was FDR's conscience and helped lay the foundations for a lot of his ideas, his policies, his New Deal projects and focuses, and all of the things that he pursued during his presidency that we sort of look back on today.
And we give him credit for. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Today, she's widely respected for the role she played while her husband was in office, but she was actually pretty controversial at the time for her outspokenness, especially on civil rights and social programs. After her husband's death, President Truman dubbed her the First Lady of the World because of her continued role in American politics, especially her human rights activism and involvement with the United Nations.
Cool.
But, you know, today we're not here to hear about her, like, impressive legacy.
Yeah.
We're here to hear about a scandal.
Yes.
A juicy one.
Ooh. I like my scandals juicy.
Yes, that's the best way to have a scandal. So... In May of 1978, a biographer named Doris Faber opened a collection of 100 and, or excuse me, geez Louise, I've had like two sips of martini and I'm already...
That's why I am taking it easy. I know myself. It's been a long time since I've had this drink.
Yeah.
And I would drink a lot of them.
Yeah.
But my tolerance has changed.
Yeah.
So I'm taking it slow.
That's probably a good idea.
But I'm going second, so I have to take it slow.
Well,
okay.
You want to.
I want to take it slow, but I've had this same want many times, and and I've failed myself. Yeah. So
people do like it when we get a little too drunk,
I know.
Too. Or we've heard repeated feedback that...
I think it's relatable.
Yeah.
I think it's very relatable, but I think there is a fine line between fun drunk, where it just feels kind of, you know, loosey-goosey, mm-hmm. and just like drunk.
And you can't read.
Yeah. Oh, been there.
Okay, so in May 1978, a biographer named Doris Faber opened a collection of 18 filing boxes at the FDR Presidential Library while researching a story on Eleanor Roosevelt. The boxes had been willed to the library by a Miss Lorena Hickok, a dear friend of Eleanor's, who had once been a reporter for the Associated Press. The boxes came with instructions that they were not to be opened until 10 years after Hickok's death. Inside, Faber found over 3,000 deeply personal letters that Eleanor Roosevelt and Lorena Hickok had written to one another, most of them dating back to the 1930s. Before I get into the contents of these letters, though, I want to lay down a little bit of foundation about Eleanor's early life. You already heard about her sort of marriage, but I want to go back even further and also discuss sort of how these two women met each other.
Mm-hmm.
So Eleanor Roosevelt was born in 1884 to a wealthy family in New York State. Her mother, Anna, was a well-known New York socialite and a celebrated beauty who was deeply and openly ashamed of her plain and unattractive daughter. She even nicknamed Eleanor Granny because of her disappointing looks and serious disposition.
Well, she sounds like me.
Yeah. Eleanor?
Yes.
Yeah, not Anna. Yeah.
No. Serious disposition.
Yeah.
What did she say about her looks again?
Disappointing.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Eleanor was no beauty, but who fucking cares?
But at the time, that's how you found a man.
Yeah.
No one's going to marry you if you're plain.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. But she had money, so someone's always going to marry someone with money.
Yeah. So when Eleanor was 8 years old, her mother died, and she was sent to live with her strict and stoic grandmother, Mary Livingston. She was deeply attached to her father, but at the time, he was confined to a sanitarium for his alcoholism, and that ended up killing him about 2 years later.
Wow.
Yeah. There's a lot of alcoholism in the Roosevelt family history. Her children, some of her sons were really bad alcoholics as
really?
Well. So she had a very complicated relationship with alcohol.
Yeah.
Her whole life. And she hated the FDR's children's hours.
Oh, for that reason?
Yeah.
Because he was drinking?
Yeah.
Okay.
So in the summer of 1902, Eleanor bumped into her father's fifth cousin, FDR, on a train. And you guys already know from last month how that all played out.
Yes.
If you haven't heard last month's episode yet, I'd recommend you stop here and go back to that one and listen to that one first. I mean, I think this story stands up on its own, but I think there's a lot of context.
Yeah. They're different stories, but there's a lot of overlaps.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
It's like the foundation.
Exactly. Yeah.
That you should listen to.
Lorena Hickok, her story... So she went by the name Hick. I just want to put that out first. I'm going to be calling her Hick for most of this. She also lost her mother at an early age. But while Eleanor had been raised in the lap of luxury, Hick had grown up poor in rural South Dakota. While Eleanor grew up surrounded by governesses and maids, Hick had actually worked as a maid after she escaped from her abusive father.
Wow.
Eventually, Hick would become one of the most respected journalists at the AP, the Associated Press, during a time when female reporters rarely made it past the society pages. She did her best to act like one of the boys so that she could sort of stand up on her own.
She's wearing pants.
Yeah, yeah. Unlike the prim and proper Eleanor, Hick was abrasive, drank like a fish, swore like a sailor, smoked cigars, played poker, and basically said whatever the fuck was on her mind.
Ooh.
She was also a lesbian.
Yeah.
And was about as open about her lesbianism as somebody could be in the early 1900s.
Really? So she was out?
Yeah. To,
like at
you
work?
Know, to her coworker. Yeah, people at work knew.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
In the 30s.
Yeah.
20s or 30s? 20s through 30s.
Yeah.
Okay. Good for her.
You know, it was certain people at work knew. I think there were obviously people she kept it from for good reason.
But she was still able to rise amongst the ranks.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah. As a reporter, Hick usually avoided stories about presidents' wives because she knew that presidents' wives never made the front page of the paper. But during FDR's presidential campaign, Eleanor Roosevelt emerged as one of her husband's top political advisors. Hick saw that she was much more than just some politician's wife. After witnessing Eleanor's presence at the Democratic Convention, Hick wired her boss, "The dame has enormous dignity."
Oh.
She's a person.
What?
Yeah.
The dame is a person?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, this was at a time when people were not real. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no. We're at that time now with the First Lady. Not super real.
That's a different kind of fake.
Yeah.
I'm talking like too prim and proper. Versus now we're talking about silicone.
Well, I think there are similarities because there was a time when women were just there to be pretty.
Yeah,
absolutely. And like not say anything.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, absolutely.
Like, Eleanor was a departure from that. She had like her own way about her.
Yeah,
her own mind. She was a person.
Yes, she's a person. Yeah, she's tall. She's kind of thick. Now, she wasn't heavy, but
she
was just like.
Was she thick with two C's or three?
She was. Succulent.
How dare you? Oh, no. Oh, you guys. About 2 months ago, I found out that I was succulent by my neighbor. She stopped me in the hallway, and she's just like, look at those curves. You look succulent. And I was so confused. She's like, you got all these hips. And she's like, basically said, that ass, where did it come from? She's like, I've been looking at you. This is new. And she asked me, she said, you've gained a lot of weight, right? Like, I was asked to confirm that I had gained a lot of weight, mostly in my butt and hips. And yeah, she's 65. I can't, she can tell me anything. But it was a compliment. She told me I look succulent.
And succulent. I don't made see a, that you've gained, I would not say a lot of weight at all.
But I don't think you're looking at me as hard as she's looking at me.
That's true. I'm definitely not checking out dad ass.
Wow. Yeah, I knew that it was a compliment, but it hurt.
Yeah.
She asked me if I've been eating a lot. I'm like, oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
But so Ellen,
she was succulent as well.
Yeah. Okay. I would, she's not even, she's not thick. She's just kind of like, she's broad. She's a big woman. She's like a, sort of like a B. Arthur type.
Okay.
Sort of tall and just large.
Yeah, a little large. Stocky, large, yeah. Okay, bigger framed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay. Yeah. And she was always sort of like dowdy looking too. She always wore very simple cotton dresses and...
Well, she was older, right?
Yeah.
She was like in her 40s?
Yeah, by this point. She wore these like floral hats and she always had kind of like a granny purse and like she was very, she had a very specific look and it was not the same look as like a New York beautiful socialite kind of a woman. You know what I mean?
Okay, yeah.
Like
she was more reserved.
Yeah, but she was like, she focused so much of her time on social work that's essentially she dressed like a social worker. She was, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Anyway, so it took Hicks some time and effort, but eventually she was assigned to cover Eleanor's life on the campaign trail in 1932. Eleanor, however, was super cold and formal and distant with reporters. She worried that becoming first lady would make it impossible for her to maintain her independent life of activism and social work.
Yeah.
And so she was conflicted about this whole presidential campaign in general. But she was also intensely distrustful of the press because she was raised by society women who had sort of instilled in her that the only time a woman's name should ever appear in print is their coming out party or their marriage announcement. And anything beyond that was, at minimum, undignified, if not scandalous.
Okay.
Yeah. Hmm. So on a whistle-stop train tour of the United States, Hick confided in Eleanor's secretary late one night about her tortured childhood in South Dakota, her abusive father and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And the secretary mentioned the story in passing to Eleanor one day. Eleanor had always had a big soft spot for hard luck stories.
Yeah.
And that's sort of when she finally started to soften towards this outspoken female reporter. When Missy LeHand, do we remember her from the last episode?
Oh, yes.
One of FDR's love interests.
Ladies.
Yeah. When Missy LeHand lost her mother, Eleanor took a train up to the funeral. And she ended up having to share a room with Hick on the train. And the two ended up staying up, talking deep into the night, sharing sort of painful and embarrassing stories from their childhoods. Eleanor spilled all the tea.
Okay.
Talking about her disapproving mother, the death of her alcoholic father, the aunts who called her the ugly duckling as a child. And the constant disappointments she had with her marriage.
Yeah.
Hick, in turn, told Eleanor all about her tragic childhood, her abusive father, and her sexuality.
Okay.
Most people would have been horrified by a lesbian confession in the 1930s, or at least sort of be put off and turned off by it. But through her teaching and volunteer work, Eleanor had already known quite a few lesbians. When she'd found out about her husband's affair with Lucy Mercer in 1918, Eleanor started focusing on the women's suffrage movement and helping to educate and empower the new female electorate. And while homosexuality was viewed in the wider world as shocking and criminal in those years, in Eleanor's circle of political friends, female couples were relatively common, and she considered several of her lesbian contemporaries to be close personal friends. Her friends Esther and Lizzie's brownstone on West 11th Street in Greenwich Village became a second home to Eleanor, and the doormat at their country home in Connecticut was printed with the words, "Toujours gay."
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay.
In the 1920s, Eleanor was on a picnic with another lesbian couple she was friends with, Marion Dickerman and Nancy Cook. They were at the Roosevelt's Hyde Park estate. And while they were on this picnic, they came up with this plan to build a cottage on the site with an adjoining factory that could help low-income rural farmers learn craft skills like building furniture.
Okay, that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. They called the cottage Valkill, and Eleanor would often use the cottage as an escape from her political obligations and overbearing mother-in-law. But yeah. Marion and Nancy lived in the cottage full time, mm-hmm. and Eleanor would just come and stay with them all the time. And the three of them even had monogrammed sheets and towels made up with their three initials, EMN,
wow.
for Eleanor, Marion, and Nancy.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
A little throuple action, yeah. perhaps.
So anyways, Hicks' confession basically just showed Eleanor that she knew the value of keeping a secret when yeah. necessary.
Yeah.
So when Hick asked if she could print any of what she'd learned about Eleanor's life on that late night train trip, Eleanor simply said, "If you like, I trust you."
Oh.
After seeing how delicate and deliberate Hick was with the story she shared with the public and which details she decided to keep to herself, Eleanor knew she had a close ally on this woman, and they began to forge a relationship that lasted until Eleanor's death in 1962. It started professionally at first, with Hick tagging along to get her story for the AP. But before long, Eleanor started inviting her over for dinner or just to sit and talk when FDR was off on official business.
Okay.
In the early days, Hick was turning out incredible stories thanks to her unique closeness to the presidency. But eventually she started missing out on big scoops because she wanted to avoid hurting Eleanor and her family. Hick's work started to suffer, and her editor sent her a prophetic note telling her, "Don't get too close to your sources."
Ooh.
But it was too late.
Yeah.
Eleanor only wanted to deal with Hick on the campaign trail. She picked her above all the other reporters that she was dealing with and
yeah.
and would answer only her questions over everyone else's.
Ooh.
Before long, they were basically spending all of their time together, attending concerts and plays together in New York.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Talking politics over late-night steak dinners cooked in Hick's one-room midtown apartment. Or taking road trips upstate in Eleanor's beloved light blue Buick Roadster convertible, the one flashy luxury she allowed herself amid the scarcity of the Depression.
So where was FDR in all of this? Just doing his own thing?
Was in the White House.
Yeah,
yeah,
he was busy. Yeah.
I mean, Eleanor was busy too, but she kind of like, because Hick was a reporter, she was just sort of like her shadow.
Okay.
And so when the day was over and the meetings and the speaking engagements were done, the two of them would go back to their hotel or whatever and hang out instead of just going to the room separately.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So by that point in their relationship, I've had like two sips of
You
this
had drink. None of it. I've drank a lot more, which worries me.
So by this point in their relationship, Hick's feelings for Eleanor were getting in the way of her job, and she basically knew it was time to leave.
Yeah.
She wrote a coworker friend of hers.
Leave her job, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, not her friendship with Eleanor.
Okay.
Left her job.
Yeah.
So she wrote this coworker friend of hers, "Well, it won't be long now before she'll be yours to worry about, not mine." After leaving the job she'd spent her entire life working towards, she moved into the White House.
Oh!
Where she stayed off and on for the entire 13 years of the Roosevelt presidency.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
She and Eleanor started taking even more frequent road trips together, traveling further and staying away longer. The Secret Service wanted to tag along to protect Eleanor, but she refused to allow anyone to interfere with their private time together. So it was just these two women in this, like,
wow,
blue convertible Buick.
Yeah.
Like,
very
just going all over. Super conspicuous during the Depression. Yeah. These two big women.
Yeah. Too. I wonder if people, like, saw them and it's like, is that Eleanor Roosevelt?
Yeah, I know.
Like, who's his lady friend?
Yeah. Hick was a big woman, too. She wasn't as tall as Eleanor. She was a little on the shorter side, but she was big. She was stocky.
Okay. How tall was Eleanor? Is she really tall?
She was tall. I don't know exactly what her height was, but she's a big woman for sure. And we will post photos of the two of them on our Instagram. There's a ton of photos of Eleanor and Hick together.
I wish that there were color photos and we could see their car.
Yeah. Seriously.
I'm just picturing Thelma and Louise.
Yeah.
They have little tied, like their hair is tied down with like a kerchief.
Yeah. And they went all over the place, mostly like New England.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're not going cross country because that would be too much.
Yeah. So when they would return to the White House, they would tell FDR all about what they'd seen along their trips, the people that they'd met, the way they lived, and the hardships that they were dealing with. And these trips around the American countryside and the way that they retold them to FDR inspired Hicks' next chapter in her life.
Okay.
With her experience at the AP and her eye for detail and human interest, Hick was the ideal person to witness and report back on the toll the Depression was taking on the country and its people.
Yeah.
She was really good at gathering facts, good at getting people to talk to her, and good at vivid storytelling. Officially, she was tasked as the confidential investigative reporter for FDR's Federal Emergency Relief Administration. And in 3 years, she visited 33 states, assessing New Deal policy, the living conditions of the average American, and how politics looked to them from their point of view.
Okay.
She reported to Harry Hopkins, one of the chief architects of the WPA. He said, "Go around the country and look this thing over." He didn't want the social worker angle, and he didn't want statistics. He just wanted Hick's honest reaction as a human being. Tell me what you see and hear. Yeah. Don't ever pull your punches.
Yeah, storytelling is compelling, so I get it.
Yeah.
People don't care about numbers.
And this is at a time before the internet. This is before social media. This is before even, you know, it was not easy for the president to find out what was going on with, like, poor people in South Dakota. You know what I mean? They were so far removed from how people were living and what their experiences were.
Mm-hmm.
Along with Hopkins, Hicks sent all of her reports to Eleanor, and what she read inspired the ways that she tried to help the American people.
So I have a question. Is she's writing like press releases, or she's just...
No, they were internal reports, basically.
Internal. Okay,
yeah, they were
it.
Internal memos okay. for basically
for
just
the
for the president and
or
the
in his staff.
Yeah,
cabinet.
The people that were in charge of the New Deal.
Okay.
So that they could find out how bad things were. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Where things were really bad, what people needed, where,
yeah. Okay.
And what direction things should go in.
So she would send these reports to Eleanor as well.
Yeah, and that wasn't really part of the job, but everything that she sent to Hopkins, she sent to Eleanor too, and she would send Eleanor private letters as well with even more stories.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Eleanor knew more than like the actual architects of the New Deal.
Not surprised. Yeah. They had a special relationship.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah. Wow. Cool.
After traveling through Georgia, Florida, and the Carolinas, known in some circles as North and South Kakalaki.
Known in no circles. This was said one time and no one, it's not a thing. Tim, you know what to do.
That is a juicy tidbit. So after traveling through the southern states, Hick wrote to Eleanor to complain about the way black Americans were being treated in the Deep South. When their slaves were taken away, they proceeded to establish a system of peonage that was as close to slavery as it possibly could be. That's all a tenant farmer is, a slave.
Look at her with her big facts.
So it's said that this passionate reporting from the South helped inspire Eleanor's lifelong devotion to civil rights.
Mm.
And you know, she would not have found out how bad things were if it weren't for Hick.
Yeah.
Eleanor would use specific details from Hick's reports to lobby her husband for additional New Deal programs. And occasionally a report was so heartbreaking that she would jump into direct action, bypassing FDR altogether.
How?
When she read about the unimaginable poverty and desperation of coal mining families in West Virginia, Eleanor jumped in her roadster to go see for herself. Almost immediately afterwards, she was drawing up plans for Arthurdale with help. She didn't do it herself, but she drew up plans for Arthurdale, which was a planned community that was basically the first of many resettlement projects for destitute families built by the Roosevelt administration. And these things would never have happened if it hadn't been for Hick's, like, expert reporting and eye for detail and colorful language. Eleanor was an equally prolific writer. Her long and detailed descriptions of her days in the White House that she would write to Hick led Hick to suggest that she should share these stories with the public. And Eleanor's syndicated My Day column brought Eleanor Roosevelt into the homes of Americans 6 days a week for nearly 30 years.
Wow.
And it all grew out of these private letters that she had sent.
So this
Hick.
Was in papers? My
yeah,
day? It was
yeah.
like a column?
Yeah, she would write about her day. She would just write about like the comings and goings of the First Lady and what was happening in the White House. And she would talk about, some of it was really mundane, like okay. I cooked eggs today or whatever.
Okay.
But it was 6 days a week for 30 years. Yeah.
Wow.
So these columns are actually a really useful historical record because they talk about like on this day, this happened and the president was doing this and these people were at the White House or whatever. But I do want to mention also that they paint a very curated, sort of sugar-coated version of Eleanor's real feelings about her marriage, her mother-in-law, her troubled children, their alcoholism, and basically just her life in general. And the private letters that she wrote to Hick tell a much more honest and compelling story. As Hick toured the most destitute and hard-suffering parts of the United States, the letters she received from Eleanor were one of the only things that kept her going. "What I wouldn't give to talk to you and hear you now, oh dear one. It is all the little things, tones in your voice, the feel of your hair, gestures. These are the things I think about and long for."
Ooh, this just got real spicy
yeah.
in here.
And when the letters didn't come from Eleanor, she would write her to complain, calling herself the forgotten woman.
Aww.
But Eleanor missed Hick just as much as Hick did. It was just harder for Hick because she was on the road. In March of 1933, Eleanor wrote, "I miss you greatly, dear. The nicest time of day is when I write to you. You have a stormier time than I do, but I miss you as much, I think. I couldn't bear to think of you crying yourself to sleep. Oh, how I wanted to put my arms around you in reality instead of spirit. I went and kissed your photograph instead, and the tears were in my eyes. Please keep most of your heart in Washington as long as I'm here, for most of mine is with you."
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
In another letter, she wrote, "Hick, my dearest, I cannot go to bed tonight without a word from you. You have grown so much to be a part of my life that it is empty without you."
They could have called each other, right?
So, yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm like...
Yeah. They did also speak on the phone
Ooh.
When they could, but there were always people around.
Oh,
she's in the White House.
Damn.
Hick's a reporter, so she's
damn.
Like calling from like a store or something.
Oh, okay. She's not in the bathtub.
Yeah. It wasn't like she, you know, she's touring like the yeah. poorest places in the nation, so there were not phones that she could, you know, she didn't
but
have her own phone in her
room. She's not staying in like a camp. Oh, maybe.
She really was like okay. in the trenches.
Okay.
Yeah.
She could have been like, "Can I use your bathtub real quick?"
Just hopefully they have one of those really long cords from the 80s.
Yeah.
Can, like, yeah. So in March, Eleanor wrote to Hick, "Hick, darling, oh, how good it was to hear your voice. It was so inadequate to try and tell you what it meant. Jimmy was near, and I couldn't say je t'aime et j'adore.
Oh.
Or, je t'aime et je t'adore, as I long to. But always remember I am saying it, and that I go to sleep thinking of you and repeating our little saying."
Oh, they're so cute.
I know. So they just couldn't,
yeah.
There's people around all the time. So
okay.
they could be a
they
lot
They couldn't really
more.
Have a private moment on the phone.
Exactly.
So that's why they had their letters.
Yeah.
Okay.
In December, Hick wrote, "I've been trying today to bring back your face, to remember just how you look. Funny how even the dearest face will fade away in time. Most clearly, I remember your eyes with a kind of teasing smile in them, and the feeling of that soft spot just northeast of the corner of your mouth against my lips." As Christmas approached in 1933, Eleanor wrote, "Darling, the only real news is I love you, and two
Aww.
Weeks and 3 days from now, you will be here, and it makes me all excited inside to think about." Hick responded, "Good night, dear one. I want to put my arms around you and kiss you at the corner of your mouth, and in a little more than a week from now, I shall." After their Christmas reunion, getting back to work in 1934 was clearly painful. In February, Eleanor wrote, "Hick, darling, I just talked to you. Darling, it was so good to hear your voice. If I could just take you in my arms. Someday, perhaps fate will be kind and let us arrange a life more to our liking. For the time being, we are lucky to have what we have. Dearest, we are happy together, and strong relationships have to grow deep roots. We're growing them now, partly because we're separated. The foliage and the flowers will come. Somehow, I'm sure of it."
Mm-hmm.
In March, she wrote, "Hick, darling, I believe it gets harder to let you go each time, but that is because you grow closer. It seems as though you belonged near me, but even if we lived together, we would have to separate sometimes, and just now, what you do is of such value to the country that we ought not complain, only that doesn't make me miss you less or feel less lonely." At another time in history, Eleanor Roosevelt and Lorena Hickok might have been able to make a life together. Hick knew, though, that Eleanor's position and her marriage
were way too
important.
Yeah.
Yeah. She actually feared that Eleanor might try to leave Franklin and told her that she could not leave him.
Oh, no.
Eleanor wrote, "Hick, darling, I'm sorry I worried you so much. I know I've got to stick. I know I'll never make an open break, and I'll never tell FDR how I feel. I blow off to you, but never to F."
But he had to have known.
But he had his own things going on. Yeah. He had women all over the place. Yeah. So
he wasn't thinking about his wife probably at all.
Yeah. And if you remember from the last episode, too, they weren't sleeping together at this point. Yeah. They didn't even share a bedroom. They were basically like business partners more than
little companionate sort of arrangement.
Yeah. Yeah. He did know that they had a very close relationship. I'm not sure if he knew just how close. He liked Hick. He knew Hick, and he
had to have suspected the fact that she's living at one point in the White House.
She lived there, for 13 years. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a long time. Yeah. And it's like, she's an open lesbian. So yeah. It's like,
there's a lot of stories that I ended up having to cut, because this story alone, with as much as I cut, is long.
Yeah.
There were some stories about him too, and their relationship. Just like, he would do these like little favors for her sometimes. And
favors for Hick?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Weird. But cool.
The best times in their relationship were sort of like 1933, 1934. But as things went on, things kind of started to change. Eventually, Hick started to resent the fact that she'd never have Eleanor all to herself. And her craving for intimacy began to turn into jealousy. And this jealousy started to hurt their relationship.
Oh, no.
Eleanor started
jealous
feeling suffocated.
To who, though? Of FDR?
No, of the public, of like all the things that took up Eleanor's time and made it so that she and Eleanor couldn't spend time alone together. She really hated the public. Not hated, but resented.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard because they clearly loved each other.
Yeah, definitely.
But then they lived these incredibly separate lives.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's hard. Yeah, I couldn't imagine.
For years and years, you know?
Yeah.
So Eleanor started feeling suffocated by Hick's intensity, and she tried to sort of distance herself to help cool things down, but it just made things worse.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Hick would sort of mope around the White House when Eleanor wasn't there.
Oh, no.
But, like, everyone knew she was there. The Secret Service is like, what is going on with this woman, you know?
Yeah.
And Hick would even lash out at their friends when she thought Eleanor was giving them too much of her time and attention.
Yikes.
Yeah. After a long talk together one night, Hick wrote, "It's this drifting, or seeming to drift, apart that bothers me so." And Eleanor responded, "I didn't realize that you thought we were drifting apart. I just take it for granted that that can't happen."
Okay. But she knew.
Yeah. As the 1930s are coming to a close, and the possibility that we might have to enter the war in Europe was becoming more and more real.
So how long had they been together at this point?
They met...
like 10 years.
They met in like 32.
Oh, so this is just a few years.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is like 35.
Yeah.
Okay.
But then, yeah. And now I'm kind of fast forwarding. So okay. We're coming towards the end of the 30s. And it's looking like we're going to get into war. But basically, Eleanor just didn't have time for Hick. She found herself not only having less time for her, but needing her help less often.
Mm.
And when Eleanor first entered the White House, you know, a decade earlier, she had been really insecure and sort of unsure of herself as a first lady. And with Hick's help, she was a changed woman by the end of the 30s. She was strong. She had a voice. She wrote this column.
Yeah.
She was confident and put together. You know, when she started, she didn't really need Hick anymore. Her involvements with the NAACP's anti-lynching campaign, her wartime inspection tours of Britain and the Pacific, and later her post-war work as chairwoman of the United Nations Commission on Human Rights were all tackled on her own without any encouragement from Hick. Unfortunately, Hick spent so much of her time and energy building Eleanor up that she had neglected her own needs in the process.
Yeah.
She had left her career for Eleanor and never really regained her footing.
Oh, no.
When her field work for the Emergency Relief Administration ended, she found, I mean, she found a job, but it's sort of basically like Eleanor found a job for her.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Eleanor was like, give this to her. It's kind of, okay. You know what I mean? Doing marketing work for the 1939 World's Fair in New York City.
Okay. That's not the type of work she wants to be doing. Yeah,
exactly. And she kind of was miserable
for
a while too. Eventually she got good at it, the marketing stuff, and she did like it, but it was marketing for one specific event and then it ended.
Yeah.
Then she took a position as the executive secretary of the women's division of the Democratic National Committee. And she did like that too.
Okay.
But again, it was just sort of a temporary thing. Eleanor helped her get it.
And
there was a lot of whispering about
the two of
why
them.
Why she had the job, why she was picked for that job over other people, which is because Eleanor put her there. You know what I mean?
But she couldn't go back working for the AP?
I think it was too late.
Oh, okay.
She had kind of burned some bridges.
Yeah, and too much time had passed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When her job as the Democratic Committee's secretary ended, she floundered. She had some health problems, and they just kept getting worse.
This is like 1936?
No, by this point it's in the 40s.
So
it's
like 40. Yeah,
40 then. 43, 40 something.
Okay.
Yeah. She had diabetes and her health problems started getting worse. She developed arthritis in her hands and she started losing her eyesight because of her diabetes.
Yeah.
Eventually she started writing biographies and children's books, but then with her arthritis, she had a hard time writing and it would take her a really long time to write a story. Eleanor started sending her money and clothing because she couldn't support herself. And eventually she lost the house she was renting in Long Island and had to move into Eleanor's cottage, the Valkill cottage in Hyde Park. In 1962, Eleanor died of a stroke at age 78. There were countless politicians attending her funeral. And people came from all over the country just to watch outside the church.
Yeah.
I have a little clip.
Oh, cool. I love clips.
The little parish church of St. James, for the second time, centers the grief of a world on Hyde Park, New York. Three presidents stand with heads bowed in deference to the passing of the great lady whose favorite hymn spoken at these services began, O Lord, make me an instrument of your peace.
It was a huge funeral. There were politicians from all over the country and probably some foreign diplomats as well.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
And she lived a long life.
Yeah.
For the time.
Yeah, absolutely. But Hick was ill.
Yeah.
And
before this.
Yeah,
even.
Exactly.
Yeah.
She didn't want all those people to see her in her feeble condition. So she also hated to share Eleanor with the public. So she didn't go to the funeral. She decided instead to say goodbye privately at midnight instead.
Okay.
She,
I respect that.
Every year on Eleanor's birthday, she would go and visit the grave in Hyde Park and place a single yellow rose on the marble slab.
Wow.
She was heartbroken.
Of course. Yeah, the love of her life passed.
Yeah. In stark contrast to Eleanor's funeral, when Lorena Hickok died 6 years later at age 75, her ashes sat in an urn in the unclaimed remains area of the funeral home before being buried in an unmarked grave in Rhinebeck, New York.
Oof.
Yeah. Before her death, some of her friends had tried to convince her to burn all of their letters to protect the First Lady's reputation. And while she did end up destroying some of the most explicit ones, she decided to donate the rest to the Roosevelt Library in Hyde Park.
That's great.
Yeah.
I'm glad she did. That would have been so sad if we never knew anything.
Yeah. When Doris Faber unsealed the letters in 1978, she was appalled by what she found.
Appalled?
Appalled.
Oh.
And she asked the library if they couldn't be, quote, locked up again, at least for another several decades.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
She blamed Hick for donating the letters and insisted that she'd had an uncontrollable craving for posthumous fame.
Whatever.
Yeah. Eventually, she decided that it was her duty to write a book based on the letters before anyone else could.
Oh, no.
So that she could control the narrative.
Oh.
Her book, The Life of Lorena Hickok, ER's Friend, was published in 1980. And while she was actually a very thorough researcher and brought together some valuable information from friends who have since died, the book really did its best to muffle the story.
Of course, yeah. Friend?
Yeah.
She was more than a friend, yeah, bitch, and exactly. You know it.
Yeah. Several prominent lesbians read between the lines and wanted more information. In the Big Mama Rag, Kathy Riley wrote that it was, quote, a crime akin to turning over Sappho's poems to medieval Christian theologians.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Thankfully, the letters are unsealed. So if you, you know, if you're a researcher, you can go to Hyde Park and just can get access to them.
Yeah. But they're not like digitally archived or anything.
No, Ida couldn't find any, but there's books that, like, most of them have been transcribed now. Yeah. So
I wish they would have given it to the Library of Congress.
Yeah.
And it'd be open to the public.
Yeah.
That way.
But a lot of books have been written since telling a much more accurate story.
Okay.
Their first was
of course.
Empty Without You, The Intimate Letters of Eleanor Roosevelt and Lorena Hickok.
That's a more real title.
Yes.
ER's Friend.
Yeah, I know.
Get out of here.
There's also Loving Eleanor.
Okay.
And most recently, Eleanor and Hick, The Love Affair That Shaped a First Lady.
Okay.
Which is the book that I read in researching this story.
Yeah.
It's really,
it's so good, right?
Really compelling. It's like, I like nonfiction. I read a lot of nonfiction, especially food nonfiction.
Yes.
But I kind of thought that this was going to be like a dusty, academic, just sort of dull read, and I could not put it down.
Yeah, it's telling so their love story. So
but it's also, there's so much in the letters that are of such historical importance.
Yeah.
So it's not just the story of their love. It's also
the story of the Depression.
The story of the Roosevelt presidency, the story of the war.
So it's super, super intimate, it's, like, in every way.
Yeah. And it's intense and it's really, really good. If you want to borrow it.
Yeah.
But anyone, I recommend it to anyone out there that finds the story interesting and wants to know more.
Yeah.
There's a lot of the letters transcribed in full.
Oh, that's great.
But it's more, there's another book, the first one, Empty Without You, is more just the letters and then a little bit of context in between. Mm-hmm. This one is more of like a narrative story.
Okay. Okay.
And the letters are sort of peppered in.
Okay. Wow. That's, yeah. Sounds really good.
There's also a play. There was a play written called Hick, A Love Story.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. I love plays.
As long as it's not a musical, I will go see it.
I like them both. I love it all.
Yeah. So when Patsy Costello, who knew Hick from working at a drugstore in Hyde Park, when she saw the play in 1998, she was inspired to go find Hick's unmarked grave and to reach out to the playwright. And in May of 2000, almost 25 years after Hick's death, a marker was finally placed on her grave, describing her as, quote, an AP reporter, author, activist, and friend of ER.
That's great.
Yeah.
Good. Can I ask you a random question that has nothing to do with this? Have you seen the movie Heathers? You're kind of obsessed with it, right?
I love that movie, yeah.
So I watched it for the first time Friday.
Oh, okay.
Doesn't it feel like a play?
Totally.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
They made a TV show.
Really?
Like 2 years ago. It didn't do very well.
Oh.
And there was something about like a school shooting
in the show.
And they never broadcast the final episode because there was a school shooting.
Oh. Yeah. They couldn't just move. Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's interesting. I watched it, but it's not very good.
It's not very good.
It starts off interesting. We shouldn't talk about this anymore.
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. Anyways. Yeah.
So that's basically the end of the story. I have a little bit of sort of preface or prologue.
Prologue.
Yeah. Okay.
No.
What am I saying? Anyways, I have some follow-up stuff to say.
Epilogue. There we go. Where's that meaning, you guys?
Yeah. Oh boy. Two martinis.
I love your oboes. They're always hitting their mark. I'm like, yes. You're saying what I'm feeling.
Yeah.
And I'm feeling oh boy.
So we'll probably never really know for sure if Eleanor and Hick actually had a sexual relationship.
Well, they're kissing.
They were kissing for sure.
So, isn't that sexual?
It's, well,
when was the last time we kissed?
That's true.
There we go.
So, her children have a lot to say about their relationship. Hick and Eleanor.
Like, contrary?
Yes. And basically, they just say that Eleanor Roosevelt was very affectionate with her friends, with all of her friends. And she was a very sort of touchy-feely kind of person.
Okay.
And the language she would use, even in letters to, like, her mother-in-law that she didn't really like.
Yeah.
She would sometimes say, like, I can't wait to see you and kiss you.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, maybe then.
Yeah. But but they also had a much stronger relationship than the average just friends. For sure.
Yeah.
There's some details in some of the letters that, like, and
the hair, touching the hair.
Yeah, exactly.
That they is sexual.
They had a relationship.
Yeah.
So we don't know if they actually had intercourse, per se, but they definitely, either way, they had a very deep and passionate emotional love for one another.
Definitely.
A lot of people refuse to believe that it's even possible that Eleanor Roosevelt might have been a lesbian because they basically just have a fixed idea of who Eleanor Roosevelt was.
Okay.
There is also some evidence that Eleanor had several...
You don't know anybody.
I know.
It's so stupid that they would say, like, there's no way. It's impossible.
Yeah.
Shut up.
They just don't want it to be possible.
Okay.
Yeah. There's also evidence that Eleanor had some close relationship with other men over the years.
Okay.
Activist and author Joseph Lash, her bodyguard Earl Miller, whose wife actually threatened to name Eleanor as one of the reasons for her divorce. And David Gurwitch, who was a physician that Eleanor lived, they lived in a townhouse together, not in the same rooms, but they had like their own building together in Manhattan after FDR died.
Okay.
And they would travel together, but then
was she sick?
Not until the end. She had a very active life after FDR's death for a time.
Yeah.
But then David Gurwitch eventually married another woman, and it was said that Eleanor was like super heartbroken over it.
Okay.
But, in, you know,
she can be many things.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
In the end, none of it really matters.
Yeah.
It's none of our business what she and Hick did or didn't do in the bedroom. Yeah. The main point is that homosexuality was deeply stigmatized and even criminalized during her lifetime.
Yeah.
And her own husband fought to entrap and prosecute homosexuals earlier
sure
in his career.
He sure did. Yeah. Yeah.
And with all of that stuff did not stop Eleanor from befriending gay women, regardless of what people thought about them or about her.
Yeah.
And she maintained these gay friendships through her entire life. The important thing to take away from the story is that Eleanor and Hick loved each other deeply, and that their love for one another forever shaped the history of our nation.
Mm-hmm.
Hick encouraged Eleanor to become a vocal, progressive, idealist first lady, one that we desperately needed at an incredibly painful and difficult time in our history.
Yeah.
And Eleanor Roosevelt's legacy and the woman she became with Hick's help will never be forgotten. Ta-da!
Thank you. That was great.
Yeah.
Wow. Amazing.
I've been wanting to tell that story since, like, early last season.
Oh.
And I kept researching it and being like, there's too much. I can't.
Yeah.
And there was so much that I had to cut that I wanted to... You know,
because a lot of people have written about her.
Yeah.
Her life.
Yeah.
So.
And there's a lot about Hick, too. Like, she was an amazing woman, too. Yeah. If you guys want to find out more about these two, please do look for that book.
Yeah. And you'll put all the info in the show notes.
Yes. The info will be in the show notes. There will be photos of them on our Instagram. There's a lot.
In the video, too, that you played after
I'll
the death.
Yeah. I'll put that on the social medias.
Yeah. Because I want to see that. I love video. It's my favorite. I have video in my story.
Cool.
Yeah, the audio is great, but the video is really funny.
Okay. I can't wait to hear the rest about Huey Long, right?
Yeah, Huey Long. Yeah.
All right. Time to re-up on these cocktails.
Yes. Yes. Oh, God. Edit that out. Why is it so loud?
That was your phone, huh?
That was your phone.
It was?
It was not my phone.
My phone's on silent.
My phone's on silent, too.
So weird.
Oh. Don't understand. I'm just going to turn my phone off. Okay, I'm going to have a little sip. A little sippy sip. My scandal this episode is a continuation of the rise of Huey Long from our last episode.
Yes.
Are you ready?
I'm so excited.
I know. He's so great. So I'm guessing you're ready. You sound like you're ready to
learn
more. Oh my
God. I will never be ready because this is like peak amazingness.
He's a lot. So what do you remember from the last episode?
That he's basically progressive Trump.
Yes. Yes. Facts. Yeah. Yes.
I was quite drunk by the end of your story, so I don't remember exactly how it ended and where we left off. So,
but all you need to know is that he is progressive and also a bit of a tyrant/dictator.
Yeah. and is not afraid of doing illegal things to get what he wants.
Yes. And he's doing it for the benefit of the people.
And not like the benefit of corporations.
Yeah. I mean, he might be getting a little enriched on the side, but he is trying to help people other than himself.
He's like Robin Hood. He's stealing from the rich, yes, to give to the poor.
Exactly. So this final chapter starts with his brief but legendary stint as a populist senator who low-key never stopped being governor. Yes, and ends with his tragic but unsurprisingly violent end.
Wait, I remember that you were saying that...
He goes to Washington and gets himself killed, I think is
But like, I remember you were saying that... Oh, sorry to interrupt, but before he became senator, he refused to step down as governor
because... Yes, I'm going to talk about... Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Oh, so in truth, there was only one way that this could end, you know, horrifically, but you're never going to guess who done it. He died the way he lived, up to his eyeballs in scandal. If you're someone who's just joining us now for this episode, hit pause and listen to episode one to hear the origin story of Louisiana's kingfish.
And if you are still listening and you haven't listened to episode one, you clearly didn't heed my warning about Eleanor Roosevelt.
Yeah.
So what the fuck is wrong with you?
Seriously.
Just kidding.
Listen to us. We are your boss.
Yes. Yes. We know what's good for you.
Yes, it's true. It's very, very true. But you're in for a treat because he was crass. He was commanding. He was extremely petty, but wildly popular.
Yeah.
So maybe he sounds like someone we know.
Mm-hmm. Who could you be referring to?
I don't know. Okay, diving back in where I left off, long... soundly defeated incumbent Senator Joseph E. Ransdell in the fall of 1930, but he waited for more than a year after winning his Senate seat before showing up in Washington to claim it. He said the seat had already sat vacant for 32 years under Ransdell. So what's, you know,
God.
He's such a dick.
Oh,
but I love all of his quotes because he's such a petty.
That's so petty. It's
man.
So fucked up.
He's just like, oh, what's several more months? He was there for 32 years and he did nothing. So if you remember from the last episode, the reason Huey was not in a rush to leave New Orleans was that he had a very bitter falling out with his lieutenant governor that turned into an actual coup. One that was only resolved when Huey called on the National Guard to secure the city. So, needless to say, he was a tad bit reluctant to leave Louisiana until he had installed a proper successor. A man by the name of, aptly named, O.K. Allen.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah.
Allen.
Yes. Huey arrived in the Capitol in January 1932, following the same script that he had when he joined the Railroad Commission a decade prior. He immediately got busy challenging the status quo. He proposed a 65% tax rate on incomes of more than $2 million.
So that's like the marginal tax rate, right?
Yes.
Where it's like over a certain
amount? Yes, correct.
What year was this? I'm sorry.
This was 1930.
Okay.
32. Sorry. 32 is when he actually left to Washington. To emphasize the point, he held Senate debates with solo filibusters. Quote, "I'm beginning to be convinced by the logic of my own argument," he declared during one 3-hour long tirade.
Oh my God.
He's so good.
I've convinced myself. Wow.
Yeah. So among those who came to listen to Long talk to himself for hours was a young congressional aide named Lyndon Johnson, who was simply entranced, he later recalled. In June 1932, the Democrats met in Chicago to choose their presidential candidate. Long backed Franklin Delano Roosevelt, our friend FDR.
Dearest friend.
Yes. Yeah. And he worked hard to deliver not only Louisiana's delegation, but also Mississippi and Arkansas's to the New York governor. FDR elaborately courted Long. The kingfish was a regular guest at Hyde Park, where his plaid suit and pink tie made a big impression. Who is that awful man? Roosevelt's mother, Sarah, asked in horror.
Once. Oh, Sarah Roosevelt. Oh, my God.
You have a lot of stories from her, right? She was prissy.
She was so mean to Eleanor.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
Yeah. She hated Huey Long.
I am not just surprised
thought
by
he was,
that.
Yeah. Anyway,
very like, everything was by the book. Everything was like, society has
what
these
would they
rules
think?
And you would never break.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Like, she followed up with the Joneses. What is that like? She was trying to keep up.
Keep up with the Joneses.
Yeah. So FDR relied on Long to carry the South, but he never trusted him. Roosevelt told one of his advisors shortly after the convention that we have to remember all the time that he's really one of the two most dangerous men in the country. The other, he said, was Douglas MacArthur, who was the army general. So Long believed that the underlying cause of the Great Depression, which he would later call Mr. Roosevelt's Depression.
What?
Yeah, he had a hard-on for FDR in such a extreme way. He believed that the cause was the growing disparity between the rich and everyone else. Wealth inequity was at an all-time high. As the Depression worsened, Huey made even more impassioned speeches in the Senate, charging a few powerful families with hoarding the nation's wealth.
Where's the lie?
I know, right? You're like, I'm searching for the lie and I got nothing. He urged Congress to address the issue. He asked, how is a recovery possible when 12 men own more than 100 million people? According to him, the nation was stuck in a vicious cycle in which people had no money to put into the economy and jobs were drying up because there was no commerce. So Huey, a longtime proponent of wealth redistribution in his own state, took his revolutionary platform to a national scale in the same manner he brought his idea to Louisiana. He took his message directly to the people. The following spring, in February 1934, Huey introduced what he called the Long Plan for Redistribution of Wealth. He felt that FDR's New Deal hadn't gone far enough to address income inequity, claiming that 2% of Americans own 60% of the wealth. He proposed a share our wealth. What?
He is Bernie Sanders.
Correct. You finally
He's
got there.
Bernie Sanders.
You finally got there. Yes. Yes. He proposed a share our wealth program to put more money into the hands of the poor. And 19 months later, he'd be dead from an assassin's bullet.
Dip. Bernie.
Yeah, watch out. I hope you're wearing a vest.
Go back to Vermont and put on a bulletproof vest.
Yeah.
Shit.
He proposed this radical plan in a national radio address. Because, again, he's going directly to the people because he's doing all these filibusters and senators don't give a shit what he's saying.
Yeah.
This speech, it's referred to now as the Share Our Wealth speech. He also formed a group to promote his policies, the Share Our Wealth Society, and dusted off the slogan of his 1928 governorship, Every Man a King.
Hmm.
Yeah. So he's kicking old school. This radio address was aimed at building broad support for his movement and also getting his name out there for a presidential run, which was his ultimate goal, as we learned last episode. I'm pretty sure I mentioned this, but Governor Huey Long was so anxious to get to the White House that he built his own replica in Baton Rouge.
Yes, you did say that.
Yes.
Oh my God.
So Huey's Share Our Wealth program was designed to provide a decent standard of living to all Americans by spreading the nation's wealth amongst its people. The speech itself is nothing really remarkable. He gave a lot of speeches.
Yeah.
But there are some fairly radical ideas worth mentioning. And I think radical even by today's standards. He proposed limiting the amount of wealth a person could make annually and using the excess to fund programs for the poor. His program would cap personal fortunes at $50 million, which is $600 million in today's money that you can make a year.
I'm not even the communists.
Yeah. You can only make $600 million a year, you guys.
That is downright un-American.
Yes. So he would spread the rest around. In the speech, he discusses how the program of wealth redistribution was supported by all thinking men going back to the ancient Greeks, the Bible, and the founding fathers. He throws out a lot of stats, a lot of numbers, such as 4% of the people own 85% of the wealth, over 70% of the people don't own enough money to pay the debts that they owe. The debts owed by Americans is equal to 45 times the entire money supply at the time. He doesn't provide sources for these figures or credible authority to support his claims. But he's Huey Long, and he's a big talker, but he's also proven himself to be a doer.
Was he wrong, though? Like, were these not...
I will get to that.
Okay. Shush you.
So what will the program do specifically with all the leftover money from the uber-rich you ask. Well, everyone will be guaranteed a minimum living wage. So this bitch was thinking about a UBI in 1934, decades before Nixon.
Good fucking God. Yeah. We're almost 100 years.
Yeah.
And we're still not there.
Yeah. Well, Alaska is. Alaska has.
Do you have a living wage in Alaska?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Based off the natural resources there, they get I think it's like $1,000 a month. I'm not
paid companies or paid by the government?
By the state.
Wow.
Yeah. It's kind of its own scandal, so maybe I will go back to that.
Yeah, I have a lot of questions about that, but
it's really interesting. Yeah. So Long claimed that he had come up with a way to provide each family in the U.S. with $5,000 or enough money for a home, an automobile, a radio, and a college education.
Not just a chicken in every pot. That's all I want is a chicken in my pot.
Yeah.
Just one. I just need one chicken. Sorry.
It's all right. No, it's he had bigger aspirations than a solitary chicken in a pot. Work hours would be limited, he said. People could go back to school. The elderly would be guaranteed retirement and pension. Veterans would be provided pensions and health care. He reasoned all of this was easy to do because the problem isn't too few resources or not enough money. It's that too few people have the most of it. Long criticized the men currently in power as totally ineffective dummies who do nothing to combat the real problems at the heart of America's economic and political crisis.
I'm sorry. I keep interrupting.
No, go on.
I'm finally feeling free enough
that I can
drink my drink.
Do it.
After that first...
As you talk, I will have a sip of my drink.
If he were alive today, he would win. He's like taking
things... He sure would.
He's... Beyond
and
Bernie Sanders.
He's already done this in Louisiana, so he would have like a show and proof. Yeah, he would crush it. Literally, crush it all.
We're stuck with fucking like, what's his nuts from Ohio that's like...
Kane?
Oh my God, okay.
I have Googled him so many times because I always forget his name, and I'm from Ohio.
By the time this airs, hopefully he will have gone away.
Yeah, moving on. So his passionate appeals were not for his fellow senators or governors or even the president. It was for the people in classic Huey Long style. He urged them to look at the facts, to write them if they had any doubts or didn't understand. He'd be more than happy to provide them with as much information/propaganda needed. He signed off the speech with a greeting to his family and a last push to encourage people to join their local Share Our Wealth societies or to set up one of their own if there was none to join in their area. Long out. No, he didn't say that.
Share Our Wealth.
I
mic
wish.
Drop.
Yes. Yeah.
The Share Our Wealth Society.
Yeah, so he created that as a way to get his message out and encourage other people to create their own little divisions.
Good golly.
Yeah, he was kind of using like what the KKK does.
Yeah,
but I mean, like in a good way.
Literally, there's so many parallels to people that are awful and we despise.
Yes, exactly. It's like he's...
But if the fucking Democratic Party would grow a set and just start using these tactics,
we can't get into this right now.
Shit!
So I have a clip from the beginning of the Share Our Wealth speech. It is so good. It makes me so happy.
According to the tables which we have assembled, it is our estimate that 4% of the American people own 85% of the wealth of America, and that over 70% of the people of America don't own enough to pay the debts that they owe. How many men ever went to a barbecue and would let one man take off the table what then tainted for 9/10 of the people to eat? The only way you'll ever be able to feed the balance of the people is to make that man come back and bring back some of that grub he ain't got no business with. Now, how are you going to feed the balance of the people? What's Morgan and Baruch and Rockefeller and Mellon going to do with all that grub? They can't eat it. They can't wear the clothes. They can't live in the house. Give them a yacht. Give them a palace. Send them to Reno and give them a new wife when they want it. That's what they want. But when they've got everything thing on the God's living earth that they can eat and they can wear and they can live in. And all that their children can live in and wear and eat and all their children's children can use. Then we got to call Mr. Morgan and Mr. Mellon and Mr. Rockefeller back and say, come back here. Put that stuff back on this table here that you took away from here that you don't need. Leave something else for the American people to consume. And that's the problem. We're not going to destroy the Gulf Refining Company. We're not going to destroy the Standard Oil Company. But we're going to say that the limit of any one man's stock ownership in the Standard Oil Company is from $3 to $5 million to that individual, and that the balance of the people of America own the balance of what the Standard Oil Company is worth. All right.
He's got my vote. I'm like, yes, please.
We start from the bottom. That the 25 or more million American families shall have a homestead, a home, and the comforts of a home, including an automobile and a radio, the things it takes in that house to live on. We say to America, 125 million, none shall be too big, none shall be too poor, none shall work too much, none shall be idle. No luxurious mansions empty, none walking the streets, none impoverished, none in pestilence, none in want, but in the land blessed by the smile of the Creator, with everything to be consumed, to be eaten, to be worn, that America will become a land sharing the fruits of the land, not for the favored few, not to satisfy greed, but that all may live in a land in which the Lord has provided an abundance sufficient for the luxury and convenience of the people in general, I think.
Damn.
Right.
He would fucking win if he ran today.
Yeah, he would. It would be very hard to compete against him because he knows how to get... He tugs at the heartstrings. It's emotion is what he's...
Yeah.
He's such a compelling speaker that people love him. They despise him too, but like the people who would be voting love him.
Yeah.
So Every Man a King, But No One Wears a Crown became a title of a song co-written by Long to promote his proposal. I'm going to put a link to the video of the song in the show notes. I would play it now, but it's so silly.
Yeah, I'm sure it sounds like it would.
Yeah, the only merits of the video lie in its awkwardness, because he has this crooner play the song on the piano and sing to it while he hovers awkwardly over him, also singing. It's so weird.
Yeah, that
it's
sounds like, uncomfortable.
It's so cringy.
Oh, man.
It's great, though, but the song is trash. Unsurprisingly.
Yeah.
So in reality, Long's plan, if it was ever really like a firm plan, was made up of a series of tax proposals with no details about how to distribute the proceeds. The numbers never came close to adding up.
Mm-hmm.
One economist calculated that in order to provide just $1,400 to every needy family, so not every family, the government would have to impose a tax rate of 100% on all incomes over $4,000. Yeah.
Okay.
So critics condemned Share Our Wealth as false hope for the poor.
But didn't we had a marginal tax rate of like 90% in the 50s,
we did.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, we did. This is the 30s where things were, the rich really had it so good.
Yeah.
In like the 20s and 30s, while everyone else was struggling. But yeah, we got there eventually. Critics condemned Share Our Wealth as false hope for the poor. Quote, "This is not water for the thirsty, but a mirage," Walter Lippmann wrote. But the poor weren't dissuaded. Share Our Wealth clubs sprung up in many states, mostly in the South, but also in New York and California, had really popular branches. In late 1934, the society boasted more than 3 million members. By this point, Roosevelt and Long were openly at war. Long accused FDR of caring only about the rich out of spite. Huey blocked a $100 million appropriation bill
that the administration was pushing to finance benefits for disabled children and pensioners.
Yikes.
He just blocked it because it's like, the president's disabled.
Yeah.
Therefore, I'm going to hit him where it hurts.
Yeah.
It is around this time that at FDR's request, the FBI began monitoring his activities. Roosevelt decided that the only way to deal with Long was to destroy him. Yeah, so looking to the election of 1936, Long expected the president to lose to a Republican. Then in 1940, the nation would be ready to turn to the kingfish. In Huey's view, FDR was missing the fact that capitalism had run amok and that the vast majority of the population was suffering as a result of greed, yeah. Corporate greed. He had some good, if not great, ideas, but his style of politics betrayed his ultimate motive, power,
yeah.
All of it for him.
Yeah.
So all the while, Huey is waging a war of words in the Senate and an open, petty rebellion with a sitting president. He maintained his grip on politics back home. I don't know how he found the time, because he also had a mistress that he brought to D.C. So he could have just done that, you know? Yeah. In his tenure in the Senate, he eviscerated the boundary between federal and state politics. Whenever he returned to Baton Rouge, O.K. Allen would quite literally vacate the governor's office. He'd be gone.
Wow.
Like a ghost.
Poof.
On more than one occasion, when things threatened to go against Huey, Long had Allen impose martial law for him.
Jesus.
Yes. Long devised a novel strategy for pushing his agenda through the state legislature that involved attaching amendments to pending measures on unrelated subjects. In this way, a reorganization of the New Orleans Police Department was slipped into a measure regulating the construction of boathouses on a bayou. The oil processing tax that led to Long's impeachment was tacked onto a measure codifying licensing laws.
Wow.
Yeah. This was militant at the time, though it's commonplace now. And we
yeah, I was going to say, this doesn't sound like...
We kind of have Long to thank for it.
Yeah.
Thanks, asshole.
Yeah, all of these tactics were co-opted by yeah, the GOP.
Exactly. Because they worked.
Yeah.
So Long took a cheerfully indulgent view of his unorthodox methods. Quote, I'd much rather get up before the legislature and say, now this is a good law. It's for the benefit of the people, and I'd like for you to vote for it in the interest of the public welfare. Only I know laws ain't made that way.
He ain't wrong.
He ain't wrong. The end of any democratic pretense came around the same time that anti-Long forces openly began to entertain the idea of armed resistance against the state. In July 1934, Long proposed, and of course got passed, a tax on advertising sales by newspapers with a circulation of more than 20,000.
Wow.
The tax affected primarily the large dailies in New Orleans, the ones that were notoriously against him. Long called the levy a tax on lying. Yeah. The following month, he summoned the legislature into special session and presented lawmakers with 30 bills, many of which he drafted himself. One authorized the governor to call out the state militia at his own discretion and prohibited the courts from issuing writs to block the governor from using this new authority. All the measures were approved within 3 days. 3 months later, Long called yet another special session. As bills sailed through, one disgruntled lawmaker demanded to know when the legislators would have a chance to read all of them. When they're passed, Long said. So the special sessions kept coming, and executive power, i.e. Long's power, kept increasing. At one point, Long went so far as to stand in for an absent legislator and cast his vote.
What? And,
yes, none of the lawmakers' colleagues even protested. No one bothered even to object.
I know.
Yes. On September 8th, 1935, he drove to Baton Rouge from New Orleans to preside over yet another special sessions. Just a day before, unbeknownst to Long, federal authorities had decided to seek an indictment against him on charges of tax evasion. Mm-hmm. Although it was a Sunday, he kept legislators working well into the evening. At around 9:30 that night, as he was walking towards the governor's office, a man wearing a white linen suit stepped out from behind a pillar. According to the most widely accepted versions of events, the man in the linen suit, a doctor named Carl Weiss, shot Long in order to defend his wife's honor. Long had been spreading a nasty rumor about his wife's family, which included a prominent judge that he gerrymandered out of a job. Huh. Long had been spreading a rumor that the wife's family wasn't white, but had coffee blood.
Oh.
Yeah. In an alternative version of events, Weiss, the doctor, merely angrily confronted Long, and it was the senator's trigger-happy bodyguards who actually shot him by accident, trying to shoot Weiss.
Yeah, I don't believe that. Yeah, I believe the first story.
Yeah, most people do. But we will never know, because Weiss was killed instantly in a shower of bullets. Long was rushed to Our Lady of the Lake Hospital, where a physician he had installed a few years earlier was in charge. This physician, who was a Long loyalist, botched the surgery, and 2 days later, Long was dead.
Oof.
So that's the problems of picking your people.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're not qualified. They just like you.
Hmm.
So dead, if anything, he became even more fascinating and polarizing. Those who loved him mourned him deeply, whereas his opponents were probably dancing in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
He was simultaneously cursed as a dictator and applauded as a benefactor to the masses. People continued to publish books about Huey Long, not because of what he represents, which is populism gone awry or fascism barely averted. Books aren't published because of how he influenced American politics, like debating the merits of UBI or tacking on amendments to pending legislation, for example. Books were written because the story is just, as a whole, so salacious.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, it's crazy, the things that happened in New Orleans in the 20s and 30s. After all, this was the man who wrote what was essentially 146 pages of White House fan fiction. Do you know about this? No.
No.
Okay. So Long's first autobiography was called Every Man a King. It was published in 1933. His second book was titled My First Days in the White House.
Oh.
Very, very detailed. It was published posthumously, but it described his future presidency in vivid detail. Like, he details conversations that he has with his staff that he's picked. In it, he calls FDR worn and tired, but nominates him as the Secretary of the Navy, telling FDR, "I only offer you this position because I thought you were qualified to fill it." So, yeah, a dig from the grave.
Yeah.
In the year of Long's assassination, 4 biographies appeared, and he died in September, mind you. So, within the year, it's crazy. Hundreds of books have been written since then. In 1970, a book titled Huey Long by T. Harry Williams won both the Pulitzer and the National Book Award. In the decades since then, Louisiana politics have alternated between periods of anti-Long reformism and much longer periods of neo-Longian hijinks, what I refer to. But I think I'm going to revisit this story to continue the Long dynasty of New Orleans, because his wife took over after him,
wow,
after he died, and all of his kids went into politics, and there's,
wow,
a lot of scandal.
Okay.
Yeah, so, yeah, the end.
That's amazing.
Right? It was so fun. You can't love him fully or hate him fully. I mean, I guess you could.
I'm leaning towards love.
Yeah, me
but
too.
But clearly the methods were really...
He was a dictator.
Disagreeable.
Yeah.
To put it mildly.
Yeah, very mildly. He was, wow, trying to consolidate absolute power in Louisiana, meanwhile being senator in D.C. Like, mm-hmm, it's just unheard of.
Yeah.
What he was trying to do. But he did have a lot of really good ideas, but his methods were crazy. Like,
damn.
If he did win, maybe he would do great things, but he, yeah, would be our king.
He sounds like he has good ideas and he has respect for the poor and he wants to make things better. But in the end, it would have been more about consolidating his own,
absolutely,
wealth than redistributing.
And power.
Yeah. Yeesh.
I like him, but also I'm afraid of him.
Absolutely.
Because he inspired such dedication that, like,
I
people
mean,
who are against,
seen,
yeah,
what
that can do.
Yeah.
Yeah. He could harness the power of the masses, which is terrifying.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting to think about what that could mean if somebody was on the other end of the spectrum and they were trying to make the lives of everyday people better rather than making it easier for giant corporations to make,
yeah,
huge profits and have tax cuts and blah, 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 blah,
yeah,
blah. But
it's not black, white. It's very many shades of gray, depending on the angle that you're looking. And yeah, that's why I was so excited to find Huey Long, because it's
insane. Yeah.
When I was looking into him, I'm like, okay, obviously the FBI shot him. But it's like, no, he had so many beefs with so many people that it shouldn't shock me that just a man who was defending his wife's honor shot him.
I was not expecting that to be the way it ended.
I mean,
for him
at all.
At all.
That was fun, right? I like that they're contemporary stories, like
same
time period. Mentioned some of the same people, FDR, FDR's mom being horrified. Who is that awful man?
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
That was a phenomenal story.
Right? Wasn't it fun?
Yeah. Phenomenal.
Yes. Oh. I see what you did.
Yep. You got there.
And I'm disgusted.
Yeah, you should be. I should be ashamed. But I've had too many cocktails to be ashamed at this point.
Phenomenal. Let the record reflect. I'm shaking my head and squinting my eyes.
On that note, our drinks are empty.
Yeah, they are.
Or mine is. Stephanie's got a little bit
left. Yeah, I was trying to be responsible. My story was short. I could have indulged a bit, but I was on a mission, you guys.
Thank you guys for listening to Beyond Reproach.
Yes, thank you for doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm. America's history is juicy.
Yeah, we just add the gin.
We do. Dirty gin. This has been Tux Lurzel.
Stephanie Domingo signing off. Over and out.
Thank you to Tim Clough, our editor, sound engineer, and podfather.
Yes, our biggest fan, cheerleader.
Please rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please tell a friend, especially somebody that's interested in history or scandal or cocktails.
Yeah.
Or drunkenness.
Anyone, you know what to do and who to tell. You just need to do it.
Yeah.
Do it now.
Don't forget to follow us on social media. We're at Beyond Reproach Pod on all of the socials. You can find a link to our Patreon on our website. Please do show us some love if you're able. It would help us so much to keep this show going.
Yeah. We gotta pay Tim.
Yeah.
That's my only goal.
Yeah.
Which I should have loftier goals, but it's like...
Buying gin would also be... Toodaloo.
Bye.
Ta-da!